This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Singer, songwriter, and guitarist Steve Earle has just released his 11th CD. It collects previously unreleased recordings, alternate takes, and songs from soundtracks, including Dead Man Walking. It's called Sidetracks. Earle moved to Nashville at the age of 19 and recorded his first album in 1986. It fit into the wave of country music's new traditionalism and went to number one on the country charts. In the 90s, Earle developed heroin and crack addictions. In 94, he was convicted for possession of narcotics. While serving several months in prison, followed by rehab, he gave up drugs. His 1995 comeback album, Train A-Comin', launched what Nick Hornby described in The New Yorker as one of the most creatively successful careers in contemporary American music. We're going to hear two Steve Earle interviews today, one recorded last summer after the publication of his book of short stories, the other recorded in 1996 when he was making his comeback. Let's start with a track from his new CD. This is a song he wrote for the new film, The Rookie.
When I was a little guy, my daddy told me, mister, don't ever try to climb too high, cause it's a fall. And some dreams don't ever come true. Don't ever come true. Well, I heard every word you said, but I don't guess I listen. Every time I bang my head against a wall system, there's some.
My first interview with Steve Earle was recorded in 1996, after the release of his CD, I Feel All Right. I read him an excerpt of his liner notes. You write, when I was locked up, I was getting ready to go off on this boy that stole my radio. My partner, Paul, asked me where I was going. I said, to get my radio, and then to go to the hole for a little while. He looked at me like I look at my 13-year-old sometimes and said, no, you ain't. You're going to sit your little white ass down and do your little time, and then you're going to get out of here and make a nice record. So I made two. And that's dated November of 1995. What's the story behind that paragraph?
Just about exactly what it says.
Who is Paul?
Well, a friend of mine that I knew from the street, and I got into jail, and he was there. And he was one of a couple of people that I hung out with when I was locked up that I knew. Two of them I knew from the outside. One of them was a guy I met in there. But one of the safest ways to go in an institution is to belong to as small a clique as possible, because they'll put 50 men in one cell. And so when stuff happens, it happens a lot faster than the guards can do anything about it. So it's a really potentially volatile environment. If you belong to a big clique of people, you know, 10 guys, 20 guys, you can't control their actions, and they may do something to make somebody else mad, and that person that they've irritated may not have access to them, and then may go off on you in the recreation area or in the gym or someplace else where the situation's not so controlled. So I sort of stuck in. We had one little corner of this 50-man cell that we sort of stayed in, and except to go and take showers and stuff. And it was just people that I knew, and they did take care of me because I was very sick when I got to jail. I was withdrawing from methadone and cocaine, and I was extremely ill. And Paul got me. I had an upper bunk, and by the third or fourth day, I couldn't even get in my bunk by myself. And Paul helped me get up there, and he also made sure that I secured a bottom bunk when the upper bunk became totally unworkable. He'd been there for about a year and a half when I got there and never had been to trial. And he's still there, as far as I know.
How long were you in this prison?
I was in 60 days. I was doing a year. I was doing 11 months and 29 days. After much begging and pleading from my lawyer and 30 days in treatment, they finally decided to probate the rest of my sentence.
Now, you grew up in San Antonio in a pretty middle-class family, right? Your father was an air traffic controller.
Yeah, I was very middle-class. We moved a lot. We were renters, so we lived all over the San Antonio area. I grew up, what I really call home is a town called Schertz that's right outside of San Antonio, and it's sort of been engulfed by San Antonio now, but it was about 30 miles outside the city limits when I was growing up there. Randolph Air Force Base is there. There's about five Air Force bases in San Antonio, which are the major industry, no matter what anybody thinks.
You dropped out of high school in 1971 and really wanted to, you know, write songs and perform. You started hanging out with the songwriter Townes Van Zandt. Why him? What excited you about him? Or was he one of the few songwriters that you actually had access to?
Well, he was one of the few there were a lot of songwriters in Texas that I could have access to. Actually, it was a pretty damn good place to be a songwriter when I first started writing. I mean, there was Townes and Jerry Jeff and Steve Fromholz, and who I saw the other night for the first time in years. There was a lot going on in Austin, and of course, naturally, everybody was telling me, "Hey, this is you don't need to go to New York or L.A. or Nashville because we got, you know, the music business is coming to Austin. This is going to be the next music industry center." Even at 19 years old, I knew that wasn't true. The weather's too good, the girls are too pretty, and the dope's too cheap, and you can't get anything done in a place like that. So I came to Nashville.
You were like the kid in the crowd. What was it like to be the kid?
Well, it was educational. When I got to Nashville in 1974, this place was like a university for songwriters because it was very democratic. It got down on any given night at somebody's house, either John Lomax's house or at Jim McGuire's photography studio. There was a bunch of people sitting around and several guitars going around the room. And a jug, you know. I mean, there was plenty of drinking and carrying on going on too. But we were nocturnal. We stayed up all night, and we played our new songs for each other. And that stopped for a lot of reasons within a couple of years after I got here. But you could see anybody from like me and David Olney, who were at absolute street level, to Neil Young in the same room, and it was a great place to learn how to write songs.
Well, let's hear a song that you wrote that Travis Tritt recently had a hit of. This is called Sometimes She Forgets. When did you write this?
Yeah, go ahead. It's an old song. It's an old song. It was written during the period when I was getting up and going to the office and writing songs every day. And I wrote what I thought were a lot of really commercial songs, and they told me that they were too country, so none of them ever got recorded until this one did last year.
Well, I like the song a lot. What do you think of it now?
I'm real proud of it. It's always been one of my favorite songs I've ever written. The songs that survived to make it on the train to come in were the older songs of mine that I seemed to always dust off when I went out and did a solo acoustic tour. That was the main criteria.
Oh, okay. Well, this is Steve Earle.
If you see her out tonight and she tells you it's just the lights that bring her here, not her loneliness. That's what she says, but sometimes she forgets. If she tells you she don't need a man, she's had all the comfort she can stand. You'd best believe every word she says. Don't give up, 'cause sometimes she forgets.
Steve Earle from his previous record called Train A-Comin'. Now, you've said you first did heroin when you were 13. How did you do it? How did you get it?
Well, it's San Antonio, Texas during the Vietnam War. It's 150 miles from the border, so there's a constant supply of real strong, real cheap brown heroin, and then the Vietnam War going on. So there was lots of dope, and it was very, very cheap. Dope was cheaper than alcohol in the city I grew up in.
Who turned you on?
Much cheaper. It's a lot of people at school, my uncle, and who also gave me my first guitar, so that was sort of a mixed deal. But he finally ended up going to prison for selling heroin, and he got out. And he never did heroin again, but he's had a drinking problem for most of his life since then.
Did your father know?
My father, I don't think they knew the extent of my drug habit. My music always seemed to intervene enough. Like, I moved to Nashville and the heroin the heroin up here sucked, so I sort of stopped doing it. And it was until I got to where I could afford it, and started traveling around other cities where there were better drugs. And I slowly drifted back into doing it again. When I stopped doing heroin, I replaced it with other drugs. But it, my parents, they were aware. It became an issue around the house a few times, but I was pretty good. I was an addict. Addicts are good at getting over. And I managed to convince the psychiatrist I was sent to that I was cured, and he pronounced me cured, and that was the end of it as far as my family was concerned.
What shape were you in when your album Guitar Town came out in 1986, an album that made it to the top of the country charts?
Well, I was a functioning addict. I was probably the ultimate functioning heroin addict, but I was a heroin addict. I mean, at that point, I could lay down and get sick for 3 days and then go out on the road. It's just what happened is the same thing happened to me. It happens to all addicts. I got to the point that I couldn't get through, the 3 days that it takes to detox anymore, and it required more drugs, and I needed them all the time, and it finally got to where it was a full-time job to get drugs, and I didn't even have a guitar anymore because there wasn't any time to play it.
My guest is singer, songwriter, and guitarist Steve Earle. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Steve Earle has a new CD called Sidetracks. We're listening to an interview recorded in 1996 while he was making a comeback after kicking heroin and crack. At the periods when you were most addicted, were you able to perform? Were you able to write? Was there music in your head? I mean, had music remained a part of your world?
No, it got to the point where it wasn't at all. The last 2 years especially, I didn't... I hung out in South Nashville for a lot of reasons. It's where the drugs were, but I could have beeped people and they'd have bought me drugs. And one time I did it that way. I didn't have to hang out there. One of the reasons I hung out there is black people do not listen to my music, and so I was fairly anonymous there. And people just left me alone as long as I had money to pay for drugs. And it's not... I got to a point that it was a full-time job just to get up in the morning and get my hands on enough money to support my habit. Whether I had money or not, I still had to go get it, and I used it up at such a furious rate that I was always a little bit ahead of my royalty checks. I didn't have to do some of the things other people have to do, but I would have. There's no doubt in my mind, at the bottom had just fallen, I couldn't get any more money. I would have been stealing stuff to support my habit. It was just a matter of time.
So the habit just drove music out of your head?
It drove it out of my life. There wasn't any time. I didn't even have a guitar. I'd traded them all for dope in the middle of the night or pawned them. And I lost a lot of nice guitars. But it really was, even if I'd had a guitar, I wouldn't have had time to play it. I woke up in the morning and I was on the trail from the time I woke up until I went to sleep, which was usually 3 or 4 days later.
Did the degradation aspect of it ever get to you, of being so enslaved to the habit and having lost something that was so special for you, your music?
Yeah, I mean, it. I know when I started to die, and that was when it got to the point that I couldn't write anymore. And I knew I was dying, but I just didn't think that there was anything that I could do about it.
Now, when you were in prison, you ended up in rehab during the prison stay. So you were addicted when you got into prison. Were you able to kick during that rehab stay?
Well, I went to a hospital. They finally realized that they didn't want to be responsible for me at age... I was 39, and I wasn't in the best physical condition, and my blood pressure got pretty high, which is a withdrawal symptom, and they decided they didn't want to be responsible for me being in the Metro jail anymore. So they got my lawyer worked it out for me to go to into treatment. I was still an inmate, but I went to Lincoln Regional Hospital, which is down in Fayetteville, Tennessee, and I did my medical detox there, and that means that they basically give you medication to control your blood pressure and monitor you. And the food was a lot better there than it was in jail. It was just a matter of once I got there, I don't know what happened, but something, I guess the fog cleared because I actually had been physically restrained from taking drugs for several weeks, and that hadn't happened to me in years. I probably wouldn't have gotten clean if I hadn't gotten locked up. I know I wouldn't have. I would have just died.
After rehab, were you sent back to jail?
Yeah, which was hard because there is dope in jail, believe that. And
were there dealers inside who tried to get you high?
Not
again?
Dealers. There was a big drug roundup the weekend that I got back to jail. I got back in on a Saturday. And you're like, you know, that was just really depressing. And I thought I was going to get out. I thought they were going to let me go home after treatment, and it didn't work out. And I went back to jail, and there was a guy sleeping. The way I went back to the Blackwood jail, and that was like, you know, just double rows of bunks. There's four rows of just bunk beds in one room. And you basically sort of sleep head to head so nobody's feet's in anybody's face, you know, is the idea of it. And I'm sleeping head to head with a guy that had gotten in and then somehow missed, you know, what was a minuscule amount of rock cocaine on the street, but was a gold mine in there. You know, he had one big, probably $30 or $40 rock, you know, a rock about an inch in diameter. And it, he just, that was going around, and I knew it was going around. And the only way I dealt with it was I just sort of pretended for the first time in my life that the rules weren't to be broken. And I just said, well, I'm in jail. There's not supposed to be dope here, so there isn't. And I went to every meeting that was available to me, which was about four a week, between NA meetings, AA meetings, CA. I went to any kind of A. It didn't make any difference. And I just sort of kept to myself and just worked the best program that I could work in jail.
When did music start coming back into your head?
As soon as I got to Buffalo Valley. And in jail, there aren't any guitars.
The treatment center.
Yeah, there aren't any guitars in jail. That's just in the movies. But in Buffalo Valley, I was allowed to have a guitar an hour a day. And I wrote Goodbye, which is on Train to Come. It was the first thing I'd written in 4 years. And I wrote Hardcore Troubadour, which is actually a melody that I'd started three or four years before. But I wrote all the lyrics and treatment.
Girl, don't bother and lock your door. Sat there hollering, darling, don't you love me no more. You always let him in before, and I didn't. Just singing our same old song. They always sang before. He's the last of the hardcore troubadours. Now, girl, better figure out which is which. Whether at the moon, you son of a bitch. You're just a somebody switch now, wouldn't you? Sheets, wake up on your living room floor. He's the last of the hardcore troubadours. And now he's the last of the young night do right. Send the need to win the daylight. He's the last of the hardcore troubadours. Baby, what you waiting for?
How do you think your voice changed after a long period of not singing and after a long period of doing drugs, which can be very hard on the voice? I mean, I think your voice sounds really great and really strong, and I'll confess I'm really surprised at how strong it sounds.
Well, my voice got a rest. One thing about sitting around, you know, like shooting dope, smoking crack for a few years, I wasn't singing. And I really had gotten to the point that I toured so much. And heroin's very hard on your voice. Actively using and singing, heroin relaxes your vocal cords. You could always tell when I was high because my voice would drop about an octave. And you go out and try to sing, you try to bring, you try to hit high notes and bring your vocal cords up to tension, and there's a certain amount of thickening that happens. So there's a big difference between my voice. If you listen to like Exit Zero and Copperhead Road, it became a lot gravel. There's a lot more gravel in it from that point on, and that's still there. But I got a rest, and I think I'm singing the best on this record. And these are all track vocals on this record. Every vocal on "I Feel Alright" is the straight track, you know, vocal performance. There aren't any overdubs on it.
I've spoken to some performers who are really surprised at what it feels like to perform when they're straight because they'd never really experienced it before.
Yeah.
Is that the position you're in? Is it a different experience to perform straight?
No, it's basically that. I mean, I did it. I didn't think that I went out and performed. I would have told you that I'd never performed when I was high, but I obviously had to at the end, because if I hadn't been high, I would have been sick.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and I performed sick a lot. You know, that ended up happening. You know, something. You know, drug dealers aren't necessarily dependable people. It's just I think I'm a better performer than I've ever been. I'm definitely a better writer than I've ever been. I'm really, really proud of this record. And I was very relieved to find out that I genuinely enjoy my job, because it had gotten sort of miserable for me, because everything's miserable for a junkie.
Mm-hmm.
You get to the point, it's really nice to go out on the road and not wake up sick in the morning and not have to worry about where I'm going to get dope in a town I've never been to before. And it's put a lot of the fun back in it for me. And so I'm back to some sort of midlife crisis that's taking place in a bus, but I'm really, really enjoying being out there.
Steve Earle recorded in 1996. In the second half of the show, we'll hear the interview Steve Earle recorded last year. He has a new CD called Sidetracks. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we're featuring two interviews with singer-songwriter and guitarist Steve Earle. He has a new CD called Sidetracks that collects tracks that were either unreleased or underexposed. Earle moved to Nashville at the age of 19 and recorded his first album in 1986. It was considered part of the new traditionalist movement and went to the top of the country charts. But in the 90s, he developed heroin and cocaine habits, and in 94 was convicted for possession of narcotics. While serving several months in prison, followed by rehab, he gave up drugs. He since recorded several critically acclaimed CDs, started his own record company, E Squared, and produced CDs by Lucinda Williams and Ron Sexsmith. Last summer, he published his first book, a collection of short stories called Doghouse Roses. That was the occasion for our second interview. I asked him when he started writing fiction.
Let's see. There's a story in here called Wheeler County, which I actually started in 89 or 90, thinking it was going to be a novel. And but the truth of the matter was, my drug habit was getting out of hand by that time, and I was having trouble even finishing records by that point. And I started pawning everything that wasn't tied down in my house, including the computer that the book was in. And I never backed it up, so that's gone forever. And when I got clean and got out of jail, I hadn't written a song in 4.5 years, and I wrote another record fairly easily. But I guess I was a little paranoid in there, and it seemed to me like I had all this time and energy on my hands, because I didn't have to wake up and find $500 worth of dope. So there wasn't always a melody lying around, so I started writing fiction to write something every day as an exercise. I'm not even sure I ever really thought about publishing it at first. And the first thing I did was I reconstructed Wheeler County from memory and found out it was only a short story after all.
All right. I'd like to take a subject about which you've written a song, a short story, and a nonfiction piece, and the subject is witnessing an execution. Before we hear, we'll start with the song, but before we hear it, tell us a little bit about the person whose execution you witnessed.
His name was Jonathan Wayne Nobles, and he was one of several people that I corresponded with on death row around the country. And at one time, I think that was what the extent of my activism was I knew some guys on death row, they wrote me, I wrote them back, and I probably got a little too close, and John was in Texas, and he eventually got a date, and he wasn't innocent. He was guilty. For some reason, innocent guys don't write me. All my guys are guilty. But he asked me to witness his execution, and I was totally unprepared for that and didn't know how to say no, so I said yes. He just wanted one person there that didn't hate him.
What was he guilty of? What was he convicted of?
A really, really heinous double murder. John was probably, in his own estimation, he was an escalating, sexually driven serial killer that happened to get caught the first time.
How did you end up corresponding with people on death row?
I wrote a song in 1990 called Billy Alston, and I've always been opposed to the death penalty. I grew up in Texas in a home that was opposed to the death penalty, and it was just what I was taught. I was just taught that that's probably not a good thing for us to be as a people and for our government to be involved in doing, for a lot of reasons. Then I wrote a song called Billy Alston that sort of deals with the subject, and then people from the movement started calling and writing me, and then inmates started writing me. And over the years, it sort of, you know, then my life got out of hand. And when I came back shortly after I started making records and being visible again, Tim Robbins called me, and he had just finished Dead Man Walking, and he asked me to write a song for that soundtrack, and that was LS Unit 1. And then all of the cast members of that soundtrack record did a benefit here in L.A. for murder victims' families for reconciliation. And meeting those people was a mind blower because they're murder victims' family members who are opposed to the death penalty and go out and work against the death penalty every day. Bud Welch's daughter was killed in the Oklahoma City bombing as a member. And they changed my life and the way that I approach my activism against the death penalty in this country.
So tell me something about what you saw or what you felt when you were witnessing Jonathan Wayne Noble's execution that ended up in the song that you wrote.
Well, I think the deal with John is he was suspicious of abolitionists, and his first priority, I think, was the victims' family members, including, in fact, he met with 2 weeks before he was killed. He met with the mother of one of his victims. You know, John had changed. They didn't kill the same guy that they locked up. He still was very confused by what he did, but he converted to Catholicism, and he was a third order Dominican by the time he died, and he was a huge supporter of other people on death row. He stood up with Cliff Boggess, who was executed a year before him, who is another one of my correspondents, as his godfather at his baptism. And he started out being one of the most hated people by inmates and guards alike when he got there. And, you know, 12 years later when they killed him, he was loved by everyone at Ellis. In fact, I spent most of the day after he was executed delivering flowers and other gifts to people, a long list of people that worked for the prison system that John wanted to make sure that they knew that he appreciated, you know, what they'd done for him.
Yeah, in your song, there's a line about who he wants, what his radio and his fan given to.
Yeah, John was. They've moved the guys in Texas now. Back then, they were on LS1 unit, which wasn't air conditioned, and it's Texas. And in fact, a year before John was executed, a diabetic death row inmate died in his cell from heat exhaustion. So fans are, you know, a real commodity, and you don't have a fan unless somebody in your family can buy it for you. So there were lots of guys that didn't have fans, and so John left a fan. He left a radio. He left his dictionary. I've got. I spent 2 days planning for the funeral of a living, you know, helping a living, breathing man plan his own funeral and the distribution of what goods he had.
Anything else you want to say about the song before we hear it?
It was part of a process that I'm probably still going through of processing having, it's not a political song. My other death penalty songs are. They deal with my opposition to the death penalty as an idea. This is simply me processing the fact that I witnessed a horrific act.
Okay, this is Steve Earle, his song Over Yonder, Jonathan's song.
I suppose I got it coming. I can't ever pay enough. And all my ripping and running, I hurt everyone. There's another place beyond here. We're happy, free. Yeah, that's what I believe.
Steve Earle singing Jonathan's song. Let's get back to the interview we recorded last summer after the publication of Earle's collection of short stories, Doghouse Roses. Before I ask you to read an excerpt of your short story, The Witness, about witnessing an execution, I want to ask you what you were most unprepared for when you witnessed the execution of Jonathan Wayne Nobles.
My own empathy for the people that had to participate in that execution. John was really incredibly well prepared, and it was hard to watch. He was genuinely remorseful, and you know, he was just trying to die the best that he could. But the other people, I don't know where it came from. I didn't see anything from them that would normally evoke empathy, but it just dawned on me what I was looking at was people protecting a relatively low-paying job with halfway decent benefits. It's the only industry in Huntsville, Texas, and is the prison system. And you know, this damages everybody that touches it. My objection to the death penalty is not about what it does to the guys on death row as much as it is what it does to all of us. I object to the damage it does to my spirit if I kill somebody, and if my government kills somebody, then I'm killing somebody.
Well, let me ask you to read an excerpt of The Witness, and this story is told from the point of view of a corporate attorney whose wife was murdered, and the man convicted of murdering his wife is about to be executed. The corporate attorney is there to witness the execution, and at this moment is in the story, the man being executed has just picked up his head and stared at the observers. You want to pick it up from there?
Yeah. He mercifully turned away. Staring straight up at the ceiling, he took a long, ragged breath, closed his eyes, and began saying a Hail Mary in Spanish. Gordon noticed that Chaplain Meeks was resting his right hand on Camacho's leg just below the knee. For some reason that he couldn't explain, the contact offended him. Now more than ever, Gordon wanted the whole horrible business over with. Finish. What Gordon didn't know was that the Hail Mary was the signal that Camacho had agreed to so that Warden Larkin knew he was ready, and Gordon had missed the warden's subtle hand signal to the unseen executioner behind the one-way glass. Therefore, he had no way of knowing that the poison had already made its way down the plastic tubing and was racing through Andres Camacho's body. Ahora y en la hora de la muerte nuestra. Andy's prayer was interrupted by a sound from his own lips. A low-pitched bark, a startling incongruous sound like a small child with whooping cough, as the air was suddenly forced from his lungs and his head pitched forward until his chin lodged on his chest. It was as if an invisible anvil had been dropped on his chest from a great height. It was much more violent than Gordon had ever imagined it would be. He had somehow convinced himself that this would be different somehow. On paper, it was efficient and clinical. Instead, there was the unmistakable sense that he was witnessing a soul being brutally and unnaturally ripped from a human body.
Now, you know that kind of barking that you're describing, that the executed man goes through at the moment of death? Is that something that happened in the execution you witnessed?
Yeah, and it varies. I mean, some people, I know people that have witnessed executions. I was fortunate enough to have a lady named Karen Sebung, who had witnessed an execution before me, who I was friendly with in Houston. That prepared me to some extent for what I was going to see. And it's different. I mean, some people yawn and some people, there's a gasp. But basically, it's a massive dose of pentobarbital. And we're told that that's to put them to sleep before the second chemical collapses their lungs. And the truth of the matter is a massive overdose of pentobarbital collapses your lungs. The second one makes sure that they don't inflate themselves because people have different tolerances to drugs. What I saw in John's execution was John was singing when he was executed. His signal was he sang Silent Night. And when he got to the line Mother and Child, the sound was so loud it was like huh, and then he didn't make another sound and he didn't move. But as he expelled that air, his head pitched forward violently enough that his heavy plastic prison glasses fell off of his face, bounced off of his chest, and landed on the floor.
My guest is singer, songwriter, and author, Steve Earle. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Steve Earle has a new CD called Sidetracks. Let's get back to the interview we recorded last summer after the publication of his book of short stories. It will be published in paperback in June. Influences that you've recently gotten deeper into include bluegrass and the Beatles. And there's a lot of harmony in both of those, although the harmonies are different.
Yeah.
Have you gotten more involved in singing harmony?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've gotten... I write... The main thing that's changed in my writing is I write more chick songs.
More chick songs? What does that mean?
it means I write a lot more pretty songs, and which serves several purposes. I've become more interested in melody. It also prevents my audience from getting exponentially hairier and uglier as time goes on, because I have to look at them, too.
So let's get back to harmony.
Harmony's like something that's been a weak suit for me. And I was always a really bad harmony singer. But from singing with people that were good harmony singers over the last few years, I've gotten better at it. And so I don't automatically break out when someone, you know, people will very casually ask you to come sing harmony on their record and as a guest. And that used to cause me a lot of consternation. And now I feel a lot more confident when I'm asked to do that, because I think I understand how harmony works a little bit better.
The title story in your new book, Doghouse Roses, is about somebody who's kind of leaving town. It starts off with somebody who's leaving town after
right.
a relationship has fallen apart. And, you know, we've been talking a little bit about how you've been writing about similar subjects in your songs and in your stories. The idea of being on the road or hitting the road it's one of the oldest subjects in certainly in country music and in rock music and the blues. And even on your new CD, on your most recent CD, Transcendental Blues, there's two songs about the road. And one of them is about the person threatening to hit the road and burn the house down.
Right.
And in the other, the person has been on the road and they're thinking giving up the road and hanging up their highway shoes.
Right.
And they're really good songs that are opposite sides of the same coin. I'm wondering if that's been a theme in your life, the desire to hit the road and the desire to get off the road.
Sure it has, but, you know, and I'm dealing with it right now. I'm getting towards the end of the tour. I'm in the best relationship I've ever been in my life. I like to be home a lot better, you know, a lot more than I used to. And Sarah is sort of like, well, you know, like almost everybody else I've ever been with, it's like, well, I knew you toured, but I didn't know you toured. And this tour's gone on longer than I intended it to. And so I'm ready for it to be over with. At the same time, I am. I have to admit that I do. When I'm home for an extended period of time, I start wondering what it would be like to get back on a bus. And I like to roll after the show and spend the night on the bus and wake up in another town. And I've been doing it for most of my life, but things are slowing down a little bit. And actually, another town was written. The one about burning the house down was written. I was using tools that I'd been using in writing songs about leaving towns all my life and trying to lend somebody else a voice, because that song was written for Sarah to sort of lend her a voice. And when we first met and she was in a situation where I think she needed to make a move, and I was just sort of being a cheerleader there. Whereas Steve's Last Ramble is a little bit more just me.
Well, I thought maybe we'd play the beginning of those back-to-back.
Okay.
And compare these two instincts. Steve Earle, I want to thank you so much for talking with us about your music and your stories.
Thank you. Rambling around and hanging up my highway.
Our interview with Steve Earle was recorded last summer after the publication of his collection of short stories, Doghouse Roses. It will be published in paperback in June. Earle has a new CD called Sidetracks that collects previously unreleased tracks, alternate takes, and songs from soundtracks. This is Fresh Air.